You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Good evening, Greenbelt. How are we doing? We're back on schedule, I am so pleased to tell you, which means that we are here to have conversation between Simon Hall and the stupendous Corin Bailey Rae. Yes, I am turning into a fangirl. Welcome back to Pagoda. I know some of you have been more or less living in our venue where we have great ideas, great conversation. And now, with no further ado, may I introduce Simon Hall and Corin Bailey Rae.
Hello. Hi.
Good evening. Now, I'm guessing that most of you here are looking at the person next to me and knowing, well, I know who that is, but I don't know who that is. So let me just introduce myself very, very briefly. My name is Simon Hall. I was a trustee for Greenbelt in the noughties, I think we still called it, in those days. And I've been coming to Greenbelt since 1983. So very much part of my bloodstream. But to go back to the 90s, I met a 14-year-old person called Corin in about 1992. So let me introduce my dear, dear friend, Corin.
Hello. How are you?
I was hired as a youth pastor in a local church in Leeds, and I remember one of the people that interviewed me said, "What do you care about? Because whatever you care about is what the young people will end up doing." We had a youth worker who was really into climbing, and they had all the young people climbing up, you know, mountains and things. "What are you into?" And I said, "Well, I guess I'm into music." And well, here we are. Can you let people know a little bit about the kind of musical world that we inhabited in the 90s?
Yeah,
of course. That you kind of grew up in.
Yeah, I'm going to unravel this so I can hold it. That might be a good idea. Can you guys see me okay? I'm going to move this out of the way, I think, because then I'll be free, a little bit more free. So Simon was the youth leader at our church, which was called Moortown Baptist Church in Leeds. And hey, you know that? Do you know that church? Yeah, some of you do know that church. So you came in the early 90s. I remember the youth leader before, but we didn't really know him so well. But I remember Simon made a really big point of visiting all the kids, you know, all the young people in the houses. And I remember that you always made a big point of coming to our house. And you said it really made you feel at home, because it reminded you of your family. And, you know, at that time, my parents had got divorced. It was me and my mum and my two sisters, so three girls in the house and my mum. And I feel like you came to hang out at our house often and have pizza and chips. And
amazingly good fried chicken.
Yes, yeah, my mum always cooks really nice food. So it was nice to have Simon as our youth leader, but also sort of like part of the family as well. And your music, I mean, you had come from a sort of goth background, I had gleaned.
Yeah, but I was a weekend goth.
Yeah, so it was the early 90s, so there was a really big alternative music scene, which I was really into. You know, music before then, or around that time, the mainstream scene was, you know, dance music. To be part of that, you had to have, you know, the right trainers and the right track suits. It was really expensive. The kids at our school that were into that scene, you know, they had all the gear. And I remember when grunge came to our school, you know, became the popular music, I was so relieved, because you didn't have to have, you know, 80-pound trainers, and you didn't have to have a matching shell suit and all of that stuff. Like, I remember buying a bag from the Army and Navy store and stitching on my initials and crocheting a little sunflower. And that was my school bag, and it cost me about £7. And so I think for working class kids in Leeds, grunge was not just incredible music, but all the fashion that went with it, because it was DIY and it was anti-capitalist and anti-label. It was such a way in. And Simon had a really great CD collection, as it would have been. And you had this sort of boombox, I remember. It's kind of like green, and it's like it had two exists. Speakers at the end. So he would always bring that into church and would listen to your music, and you know, so he would say, "Oh, have you heard this record?" And it would be, you know, Bjork's debut album, or I think, you know, we were really into Jamiroquai, and it's like, "Oh, if you're into that, you know, you should listen to this." And or you know, we'd like Lenny Kravitz. He would say, "Well, Lenny Kravitz, you know, Lenny Kravitz just sounds like Led Zeppelin. You know, you want to get into this record and that record." So it's a bit like having an older brother who would always tell you a cooler or more sort of authentic band that you should be into, that was kind of the big influence to the thing that you were into. So I guess we got into a lot of, you know, 90s grunge music together. We all loved Nirvana, and we liked Pearl Jam, and you liked, you know, David Sylvian, and, you know, introduced us to all this music, me especially, you know, to music that I wouldn't have really been aware of as kind of the 10 years that happened before. But I also think at church your big thing was letting us make music in the manner of songs that we loved and worship music we had. I mean, I guess you could talk about that because you had that background from Sheffield.
Yeah, for the 9 o'clock service.
Yeah.
We can talk about that another day.
It's like, you should talk, Mom. I'm like, you should talk. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And also over the years, lots of people, some people here will know Pete Ward and Oxford Youth Works. They trained me to say, well, if there's a gospel, if there's a Holy Spirit, then it can live and grow in any culture and not just a sort of specific religious culture. And that's, I guess, what we were doing. I was just saying to Corinne earlier that I found the founding documents of the church that we ended up setting up together about 25 years ago. And we were the first two signatories on the kind of founding document. So that's our background. And then you stayed, partly because of the church, you stayed in Leeds, you went to uni, started working at the Underground, where you were exposed to more music.
Yeah, I mean, I was really into my band, Helen.
Yeah.
You know, I felt like everybody, when I was 15, everybody I knew was in a band. So that was just what you did. You know, so like how kids play computer games now or something. So everybody I knew was in a sort of post-feminist riot girl band. That was just what you, that's just what you did. So, you know, like in between your GCSEs or whatever. So we had our sort of rivals. It was even another band in our church that were, you know, also on the music scene, and they were our kind of contemporaries and rivals. But we had there would be other sort of like boss girls in different schools that I would keep an eye on and see like what music they were making and what shows they were doing. And, you know, Simon bought me my first electric guitar, which was really kind. And that was the guitar that I sort of went out with and started this band, Helen, with my two best friends at the time, my best girlfriends and my boyfriend at the time. And so I think, you know, the church was really great for kind of making this space where young people felt they had authority to do things. I mean, I used to, alongside with you, sort of lead worship in church. It was a big church. I mean, how many people were at Moortown on a Sunday night? Like 200 people, maybe?
Yeah, 200, 250.
And I was so tolerant of the adults to allow the sort of young, you know, firebrand Christians who were really angry about how much money was being wasted polishing the parquet floors when it could have been given to charity and there's homeless people on the street. Like, we would sort of stand up and pour our, you know, pocket money fueled sort of righteous anger at the older generation. And they were so graceful in letting us bring that sort of understanding of this kind of radical Christianity, which we had discovered and found was all there written down in the Bible, and wanted to know, you know, why is anything spare in our church? Why isn't it all going to, you know, heal the sick and feed the poor? So I felt like you really encouraged this culture in the church of, hey, you're 15, you know, of course you can lead worship for 200 adults, of course. And we had this thing where, I mean, you always said, you know, you watch me do it, then you do it with me. It makes me feel emotional. You do it with me, then I do it with you, and then you do it on your own. You know, and that was really the model, and that's how I started leading worship in church. And then, you know, playing my band was kind of parallel to that, and one thing fed into the other, so that, you know, by the time I got onto the sort of dirty indie scene and the, you know, the dive bars and the mosh pits and everything, I had already done a lot of performance or leading or however you would call it, this kind of really similar things to one another. So I arrived on that scene as kind of really confident, and that so much of that came from, you know, church and obviously, you know, Simon's kind of direction.
And I think people will maybe recognize a bit of that tonight.
Yes.
In terms of what you're going to do.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, I hope so. You know, I feel like, you know, all musicians have that. They have that thing of you're channeling something, you know, you don't imagine that it's coming from you. That's ridiculous. You know, all the best musicians I know, like going sort of really high up to really well-known people or people, long-established people, they all know that it's something that comes through them, that it's not them. It's not their sort of special ability and what they can do on an audience, but that you're all sort of there together in that moment and being the people who are on stage playing the sounds, you know, that you, the best thing to do is kind of get out of the way, and they're the best, most favorite shows for me and favorite parts of the show when I feel like I'm sort of invisible and it's all kind of happening, you know. So it's directly relatable to when I would lead worship in church or something. It's the same experience.
Wow. Just tell us a little bit about how you got from being into L7 and Hole and then bringing out a really sweet, and I mean that in the broadest sense of the word, pop album that was an incredible success around the world, made you a name all over the world. How did you make that jump?
I think... you know, I was open to lots of different influences. So I had this indie band, but when I went to university, I also worked in this jazz and soul club called the Underground. And I worked, yeah, some of you guys would go out to those nights, right? So it was a really amazing place and a really amazing place of community. And I think for those of us that, you know, grew up in church, we found this sort of parallel community of alternative people, of jazz bohemians, you know, people, some of the values were the same, right? So it wasn't, oh, how can I get a fancy car and a really good job and a big house? It was the same rejection of those things. You know, these people, they were just like, how can I be as good as Charlie Parker on the saxophone? Or, you know, how can I be a brilliant vocalist? How can I collect as many records as possible so I could absorb as many influences as possible so I could really, you know, become what I want to be in music? And so I think, you know, getting to hear jazz, getting to sing with other musicians, you know, outside of my sort of DIY, you know, indie band, and be with people who were really, who had real musical skill and being sort of caught in the updraft of that, you know, and being able to find that I could do things I didn't realize I could do, or hang in a particular way that I wasn't aware of, or improvise or hear in a certain way. You know, that was a real buzz for me. And then, you know, we had a manager. I had someone encourage me to write more songs. I wrote more songs on my own. And when I got in the studio, it was really, it was a real rare treat to be able to actually hear myself, you know, because normally on gigs, you know, really loud guitars, you're firing your singing out over these loud guitars. And, you know, we did have some quiet bits, mostly the verses, and loud bits, mostly the choruses, which, yeah, you know, that was...
I think Pixies were the kind of archetype.
Yeah, that was kind of like all that music had that structure. So, I, you know, it was amazing to be in the studio for the first time and put on headphones and be able to sing in this really conversational and intimate way. And that was a big influence on that first record, as was, you know, being into soul, being into jazz, having these friends who are musicians, you know, a lot of them played on that record. So that record just came out in that way, and that was just part, I just felt it was part of, you know, absorbing all these different influences.
And how did your life change? Because, I mean, people know you for that album in this country, but it really became a global thing. You sold millions of albums. You became part of kind of R&B aristocracy in the States. What did it feel like to suddenly just, not quite overnight, but it was pretty much overnight?
It was really quick. I remember, like, I did four residencies in London, and the first one, it was in this place called the Cherry Jam. I remember the first show, you know, quite a few people came. It wasn't full, but it was nice, like, to play in London, you know, the big city. I'm from Leeds, so it's like, wow, I'm in London and people are coming to see me. And then I remember the second time, it was really busy. You know, the week later, the following Thursday, it was, you know, packed, totally packed. And then I remember the third week, like, people couldn't get in. And the fourth week, I was sort of late arriving because I just played on Jules Holland. So it was really just lots of things happening in a row that week. And I remember, you know, I'd done this Jules Holland and I'd been chosen as, you know, BBC kind of, this is going to be a big deal next year. But I still didn't really, you know, expect it to happen the way that it did. And yeah, I just remember being on tour and getting a phone call that said the album was number one, and yeah, I was really surprised. Again, I was so used to playing live where I knew everyone who knew us, you know, like I knew the sort of 75 Helen fans that there were, you know. When people say,
I used to watch your band tonight.
Yeah, you see, these guys, they used to come out and watch me, and it's like, I know who those people are. And when people say, I used to watch your band, I'd be like, I don't recognize your face, because I knew who the faces were. And there were people, local people, people from my church, people from our, like, school, you know, school kids, and a few parents, you know. So, but to suddenly be, like, at the Grammys and Mary J. Blige has heard the record, or, like, Stevie Wonder's calling me to play on his radio show, or Prince came to see one of our first shows in America. It was really, I was just really shocked. I was really shocked by where the record had gone to. And I realised, I went to the record company once and Put Your Records On was playing. And I said, oh, are you playing my song? And they said, no, it's on the radio. And I said, oh, wow, it's amazing. And they said, no, it's on quite a lot, you know. So it's like, I just didn't, it was totally new for me. And I had worked really hard in music before and sort of not got nowhere. You know, we won our Battle of the Bands competitions. We made our demos, you know. But just suddenly it was just it was kind of everywhere. And then it was just, you know, airplanes and, you know, loads and loads of shows and getting a private plane to Oprah and playing at the Grammys. And, you know, it was just it was a lot of things. It was a lot of places and a lot of things. And I felt like I really enjoyed it. I wasn't super young, you know, it was in 2006. So I was 25, you know, it was not like I was 17. So I was sort of ready to feel some appreciation and grateful, you know.
So Greenbelters, we can pat ourselves on the back because we think it was 2005 when Corinne, I phoned up the program manager and said, I've got this friend, which is generally how Greenbelt works. I've got this friend. She's really good. Could you get her a slot on main stage? Unfortunately, they said yes, and you were squeezed in for like half an hour.
I remember playing it, and it was in the afternoon.
Absolutely storming.
Brilliant. Yeah, I mean, they were all sort of new songs for me, and I hadn't really tried them out. And that was the difference as well. Like, the first time I played those songs, it was, people knew the recordings of them, you know, so that was, it was different. You know, I'd go to all these countries and think, how do they know the words? You know, so it just took me ages to kind of catch on that people were going to come, even though it was in South Africa or Switzerland, or, you know, people were going to come and that they were going to know the words. I was really happy.
And then there was another shock. In the midst of all of that amazing creative music scene, the jazz scene, you'd fallen in love and married Jason, and then completely out of the blue, he was gone. And that's not something that anybody wants to live through. You were in the middle of just getting ready to record a new record, which became The Sea, which became just a completely different musical experience. Can you talk us, I mean, you're in a tent full of strangers, you can say what you like, but that was a huge moment in your life. Discombobulating is a nice English word for it, but talk us through that.
Yeah, it's funny because that period between the record, you know, like having this success, and then in 2008, which is the March when Jason died, who was my husband, it's that period in my mind sort of stretches, you know, it's years and years and years and years. It's not only 2 years, but I think, you know, he and his band, it was the Haggis Horns. They were the horns for our tour. And then eventually, you know, we stopped working with them and they started working with Mark Ronson. So I think when I came back from all my touring, I remember then Jason was off, you know, with Mark Ronson, and I was so happy that he was getting to do that work. And then, yeah, I was recording, starting another album as well. I think, you know, I think anyone who loses a partner, especially in a way that's unexpected, although I'm sure it's kind of similar if someone's died of a long illness or something, it's obviously a huge shock, but it also sort of feels like the end of your life. I feel like marriage, so much of the work you do in a marriage is kind of trying to sew yourselves together and kind of dissolve the gap between, you know, each other. And I think especially when you're young married, you know, and you have that, all the sort of the kind of newness and romance and all of that. And I think it was obviously a massive shock, but also it sort of felt like the end of my own life as well. And also because the work that I did was so public facing and I had no capacity to do that. It was just like sort of looking at a calendar with nothing in, you know, like, and I remember sort of thinking like, how many months is it of this, you know, of this feeling, this sort of empty feeling, or this really, you know, frightening feeling. I remember really being frightened of the future and thinking like, how could I possibly live through all this time? Time seemed really endless. Like I'm 29. Like, how could I get to be 39 or 49 or 59 with this? Impossible. It was just such a huge amount of pain. I just thought it would be impossible to live. And I think grief is like that, and it does kind of like swallow up, you know, a huge part of you, and then a huge part of your life is sort of lost. And when it's a partner, it's like the things you've built together, there's no one else who's in those memories except that person. You don't have that person. So it's almost like for a while I felt like the memories were all, like everything was underwater, and only the really traumatic parts of the relationship, they were the sort of emotional bits of peaks of mountains that were sticking up above this whole drowned landscape, and that it took a while for all of that to subside. And I mean, even now, it's much more painful to reflect on the happy sort of parts of our marriage. But I think, yeah, I like talking about grief now because I felt like when I was 29, I didn't have anyone to ask about, hey, what's it like when your husband dies and you're 29? You know, there weren't that many people who had had that experience. And, you know, there was really great books like that. Joan Didion book is good, you know, Year of Magical Thinking. But I would find myself being sort of resentful of all these decades that she had with this person. I think losing a partner, if you've known them for decades, is also incredibly painful. You could argue more so because you're even more stitched together, you know. I'm much more sort of aware of that now. But yeah, I think being that young, I just didn't really have anyone to compare experiences with, and that was also, you know, lonely. But I had really good friends. I had my family. I had no sense of needing to kind of do any career work. I felt like that was the end of my life anyway, so I was just kind of like, oh well, I had a good run, you know. That's how I sort of felt of it. And then it just took a while for like this sort of noise to come back in. And when it did, I realized, you know, I really want to finish that record. It was The Sea, and I added a few songs to it that were, you know, a lot in reflection of, you know, losing Jason, and they all sort of fit together with what I was doing. And, you know, I had a really good person at the label, my A&R person, Matthew Rumbold, who would just come up every 2 weeks and kind of give me news from the outside world. I remember like Lady Gaga had just sort of become a big thing. So he'd open his laptop and be like, oh, you've got to see this. This is totally bonkers. And that video of Lady Gaga and Beyonce, you know, just sort of show me this. Or someone else would show me the Single Ladies video. Or there would just be sort of news from the outside world that would be, it'd be a fun sort of fun distraction, you know. And yeah, that just helped. And I do always think with grief, it is just sort of time. It's just a massive amount of time that you think it won't be. It just kind of like is a big time, like a huge monster that eats time.
It's funny because I was just thinking, if you've not ever listened to The Sea, I really do recommend it. And there is something timeless about it. It makes me think of Jeff Buckley's Grace in the sense of it could have been recorded in any decade, you know, over time. And it's beautiful and it's good and it's true. And some albums kind of, in the days of albums, you know, when you listen to a whole album, some albums kind of burn themselves out before they finish, whereas that one, like, just builds and builds and builds.
Thank you.
It's a great record.
Thank you.
We want to make time for you guys to ask a few questions. So be thinking of a question that you'd like to ask. But given that we're in a new world, you've brought a new album. Before we get to that, I'd just like to hear like your view. You've charted the progress of a musician in the last century. We've gone through a time where people developed careers by singing covers on YouTube, and now the thing to do is to get a 10-second snippet of a song on TikTok. How do you see the music industry at the moment?
I mean, I think that it's sort of two sides to this question. You know, the one side is like, you know, sometimes I've gone to meet producers in Los Angeles, you know, maybe we'll work together, or maybe we'll write a song together, or maybe we won't, and maybe it's just an hour-long meeting that doesn't come to anything, because that also happens. But I remember one producer I was speaking to was saying, oh, the label has got in touch with me and they want me to make this new artist, you know, they're coming through, so they need me to do like 10 TikToks. And I was like, oh, you mean you've got to write 10 songs and then kind of film a bit for... And he was like, no, we're not writing songs, we're just writing... Is it 30 seconds?
I don't know.
Who's younger than me?
I'm too old, yeah.
But like, however long the TikTok clip is, like, they just want that much music from the singer and the writer, you know, just like, just make me 20 seconds, like a really, really good 20 seconds, and make me 10 of those, and then we'll just kind of like see what connects. And when it does, then you can write the song as though it was always a song, and it will be a big hit. And I was like, I mean, there's two ways to think about it. One is like, whatever works, right? Whatever makes good music, it's a hard time to connect with people. Whatever works, like, all is fair, you know? And then there's another way to think about it, which is just like, it seems so much pressure on these young people and these producers. And apparently there's these huge stadium gigs now with these bands who are massive on TikTok. And it like, it gets the chorus and everyone's just like, you know, there's 20,000 people singing along and everyone loves it. And then it comes to the second verse and the silent, right? Because nobody knows that bit, because that's not the sort of viral bit of the song. So you just go... And then it comes to that clip again and everyone's back in it. And I was like, I wonder how it feels as a band. Do you feel loved, or does it matter? I mean, sort of none of it matters. Whatever works. Art's being sponsored by, you know, kings and queens, or the church, or wealthy people, or as it is now, corporations, all through history. So we never know where the next bit of money is going to come for the next bit of art. But I think it's hard for young people. You know, you have to be really beautiful, because the thing that's going to earn you money is not selling your music, it's selling your thing, right? So it's like, is it going to be that you're going to like have a moisturizer campaign, or like earrings, or is it going to be sneakers, or is it going to be, you know, so there's all of that kind of like lifestyle branding world. Like, I'm so lucky to have just missed all that, I think. And I really admire the young people who manage to sort of trick people into listening to their really great music while also having to do all this other bullshit on the side, you know. I do admire that they just got the hustle, you know.
So I know that... I hope you're all going to be there tonight. I know that you're going to tell us a lot about the album, but can you give us a little bit of a background of where this new album came from? Because it's not quite like anything you've done before.
it's really different, this record, to anything I've done. And yet it also draws on all these different musical sort of experiences that I have had before. I went to this building in Chicago, and it was called the Stony Island Arts Bank. I went there just as a tourist. I was really interested in how it looked. It's this big sort of Roman columned bank, you know, it's like white stone. It's in Chicago, in the south side of Chicago, which is a underserved community, is what the most recent politically correct term is for a really, you know, a poor area with its struggles with violence, mental health, housing, poverty, all of those, drug addiction, all of those things. And right in the middle of this neighborhood is this bank that was going to be pulled down by the city, and it was saved from demolition by this artist, Theaster Gates. And so now, instead of being full of money, it's full of all this art archive. It's full of 26,000 books that were collected by and submitted to the Johnson Publishing Library, who made Ebony Magazine and Jet Magazine, who were these really important African-American magazines. And they are presented in this vast library that works over, you know, it's this double height cube. It's got those metal ladders, for those of you who are into libraries, which I am, you know, so you can go up and you can walk along and you can pick out all these different spines of, of these incredible books. And they're all black books, so they're all about history and dance and art and politics and masks and Ethiopian rock churches and the black pioneers who went west before the Civil War. But there's so many of them, and I think that was a big surprise when I went there, just seeing this volume of literature in black stuff, you know, which I wasn't as... Some of it I was really familiar with, some of it I wasn't. It has all of Frankie Knuckles' record collection in there. And it also has these difficult and problematic objects from America's past. Objects for the home, postcards, photographs, newspaper articles, cartoons, derogatory objects that were saved by this black and Chinese banker. They were taken out of circulation by him. He would go to flea markets and yard sales and just scoop up all this sort of this stuff, you know, this stuff.
Racist knickknacks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's called Negrobilia, it's been dubbed, but that sort of thing. And so I went as a tourist. I was looking through drawers. I was opening packages. I was looking at photographs. I was so pulled in by all this history. And first time I went, I only had about an hour and a half. And when I left, my mind was just sort of fizzing, you know, with all these stories. You know, who was that girl in that picture? What was she doing? What's her relationship to the people standing next to her? Or I'd be really inspired. At, you know, see a beauty queen from the 1950s and think, oh, I've never seen an image of a black woman like that. You know, I might have seen Betty Page as a kind of 50s pinup, but I hadn't seen this young black girl. And is she still alive? Like, I just had all these kind of leads in my mind. And I was on tour with my third record, but all I was doing was kind of sitting in the tour bus and writing poems about these objects I'd seen. And I wanted to get back there. And so I did get back, you know, lots and lots of times over the next 7 years. I went on residencies there. I stayed there for weeks. I just read and looked and touched and kind of dreamed and imagined all these stories. And they ended up becoming this record, Black Rainbows, which I'm going to perform at 9:30 tonight.
Indeed, yes. Yeah. So I'm really curious, because you've said nice things about what we were trying to do when we were making Church, and very much in common with Greenbelt, which talks about art and spirituality and political activism, which in a lot of life feel very siloed and segmented, and like, well, if you're an activist, you haven't got time to be making art, or you haven't got time to be contemplative. You know, there's a world to be changed. And everything that you've said, and obviously Chicago is the city that gave the world Barack Obama. There are folk here, I'm sure, that will be involved in community organizing, which was also founded particularly around black churches in Chicago. It feels like there's something going on in there. And if I'm right, Theaster Gates, who is kind of the curator of this, is a minister as well. So it feels like there's something going on where all of these different things really live together quite comfortably, and there isn't this sort of segmentation that we often experience.
Yeah, I think there's a real confluence between, as you say, spirituality, organized church and an art practice as well. I mean, so much of the civil rights movement came out of these church networks. They were already organized, they were ready. You know, you could pass on a message here and it would be disseminated into all these different communities and all these different branches, the AME church, the Baptist church. You know, people were committed and organized. The practice of nonviolence was already in people's philosophy, you know, the practice of love as conquering all. And yeah, I mean, Theaster, it has his origin in the Christian church, and he was a choir director, so he has this musical group, and they're the Black Monks of the Mississippi, and their work is in the monastic and the pentatonic, and it takes in, you know, Christianity and Buddhism and sort of reflective spirituality. And then he has this practice of saving these buildings from demolition and keeping them for the community. The foundation is called the Rebuild Foundation. But yeah, he wants to, you know, enjoy himself and wig out. And of course, he's a visual artist, and that's his main work, just making all this stuff. But he says, you know, art is just as important to community as food. You know, art is the thing that feeds you. Art is the thing that keeps you going. The belief that you are part of a culture that has expression, that is a human culture, and the belief that you too can make this contribution, right? You know, if you want to put food in your stomach, it's for a reason. What's the thing that spurs you on? It's like the desire to express yourself and the desire to make art and to communicate and to connect with one another. There's really important cultural values. So I think, you know, that's been a big part of that. The Rebuild Foundation's work is, we're not just looking at food, which they are looking at. They're looking at how important art is for community and for individuals to have pride in themselves and their community and their neighbourhood. I mean, that's something I feel really strongly about as well.
And you've made a record that begins with a track called A Spell, A Prayer, and ends with a kind of, I don't know, Alice Coltrane-esque kind of wig out meditation based on an article you read about rock churches in Ethiopia. There's a kind of spirituality to it, but there's a very sort of, I hope this isn't the wrong word, a mundane political engagement, because you're dealing with small things, but they've still affected you very deeply. How did it feel? One thing, if you've not listened to the record, and you will hear it tonight, is each song feels uniquely curated to each object or event that inspired it. You're not just being Corinne Bailey Ray, R&B artist. You've created a whole kind of soundscape as well as lyrical world for each thing. How did that happen? Because it's probably not unique, but it's rare that you go to an album and at the end of each track, you could easily say, and now for something completely different.
It's true. I think I really felt like the objects were talking to me. So there was so much less brain involved than in a lot of the things that I've done before. So, you know, when I saw these objects in the bank, and they are about, you know, the erasure of Black childhood, you know, Black children sort of posed as workers in a home. You know, you might buy a product for the home called Gold Dust, and it'd be a cleaning product, you know, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and it's two little Black children, caricatures of Black children with little tutus on that are actually dusters, and it's kind of like, you know, let the Gold Dust twins clean your house. And it was totally normal to market a cleaning product for the house as like, let these Black kids tidy up for you, you know, that the sort of posing of Black children as not like white children, not to be cherished, but sort of workers. Or the Black children are shown as dangerous, or they're shown as criminals or subhuman. And you could see that for all the different human groups. So, you know, the denigration of Black men, or the way that Black women who were trying to seemingly try to look beautiful in these cartoons were posed as grotesque, or at the other end seen as really, you know, sexually sort of coniferous. And it was really shocking to see this work. So this kind of erasure of sort of Blackness and Black people that easily came sort of under my hands as a, you know, an electric guitar song. Like, I'm just playing one string in that piece, you know, I'm just playing through this distorted There's actually this speaker that lives in this pack of cigarettes, this like thing that I got in Chicago, and just this broken up sound was really kind of the resistance to this erasure. You know, the chorus says, they tried to erase you. Right? So it's really a song about resistance, but that made sense with this like this kind of distorted sound, or seeing this 1950s beauty queen. You know, I'd seen so many posters, 1950s images kind of recontextualized for feminist artwork in the 90s, you know, would say like be a picture, a sort of domestic picture of a woman washing up, or you know, just thinking at the ironing board, or whatever it was, or a beauty queen, and it would be like, you know, forget the dishes, come out and see, like, pussy power at 9 p.m. And, you know, so I was really used to those kind of posters. So when I saw this kind of 50s cheesecake image of Audrey Smalls, I immediately could hear this kind of, like, New York, Jersey Queen, New York,
I know,
Jersey
it's,
Queen. It just came like
it's
that.
It's so New York, that song. It's really? So completely, it's like a cross between the Velvet Underground and the Strokes.
That's
you know
a very
what I mean?
Big compliment.
Do you know
yeah.
what I mean? It's,
yeah,
it's just, absolutely
it's like
a New York.
It has to be like a CBGB's. Aggressive, you know, like these rebel girls, you know, that just got all this power and they're outside of culture and outside of cultural norms. And I really felt it when I saw that picture, or, you know, before the throne of the invisible God has to be kind of meditative. And we have to, in the music, make the kind of shape of the inside of this vast rock church in Ethiopia. You know, how do you make it through sound? And so all the sounds just came really naturally sort of in response to the objects. Yeah, I mean, if you're going to write a song about a house music party, you've got to be able to sort of move to it. And so, you know, the beat of that came through and through some of the music experimenting.
I'm actually remembering the song.
Oh, yeah,
like
yeah.
This.
Stephen Brown, who I work with, and Mikey Wilson, they were doing this music project upstairs. And Steve, who I'm also married to, he was like, you should come upstairs and check out this music. And I was really heavily pregnant at the time. I was like, no, I'm not gonna be involved in your project, thank you. I'm just gonna have a 2-hour bath and you know, but have fun and I'll do no work. But I could just hear this music sort of coming through the studio that's above, you know, at the top of our house. And so when everyone had gone or they'd gone to sleep, I would sneak upstairs and go and listen to what they'd done in the day, and I'd put my headphones on. And then I would just turn my microphone on and just all this stuff would come out, because I was reading all this stuff. I was looking at all these images. I was thinking about all this stuff. So it was really kind of in my body all the time. And I really felt like a lot of these stories, which have been erased or forgotten, they really felt like they wanted to be told and really just came out.
Yeah. And it's really about, you're going to be invited to dance it all out and to kneel. So it's an embodied album. Listen, I want to stop being the one to ask the question. So, but thank you so much.
Thank you.
For, you know, being so open with us.
Thank you for having me.
And so we've got a little bit of time. We've got about a quarter of an hour. If anyone would like to ask a question, don't be shy. Well, there's one right there, and I'm going to guess that's going to be a really good question, like, do you need a bass player?
Thanks so much for telling the stories. It's extraordinary. You talked a lot about the personal inspiration for the new record, but doing that as Corinne Bailey-Ray, with all of the baggage that entails, all of the success that entails, that's an extraordinarily transgressive thing to do within the context of being you. Can you speak into that? Because it feels like there is a tradition of that. There are Michel Ndiaye-Ocello or Janelle Monáe or even Joni Mitchell. Kind of there have been times when people have kind of traversed multiple genres as a mode of transgression, as a kind of act of protest in and of itself. Were you conscious of that sort of external valence to what you were doing, as well as this kind of internal story of looking at the art?
I think, yeah, yes, I definitely was. I had had a really hard time on my third record because I think, you know, I'd had this success with the first record. My second album I had made, you know, after some of it after Jason had died, and the label were very sort of cool and they let me do my own thing. But I felt by the third record, it was kind of like, okay, you need to, we need some hits, you know? And so there was this huge pressure to get these singles. And I think they thought that they could trick me. I thought that I could trick them, right? So I thought, I'll just do what I want, but then I'll give them these few songs. And they would say to me, you know, just do whatever you want on the rest of it. We honestly don't care. But, you know, think of these songs as a nightclub. You're trying to get into a nightclub and all you need is like a tie on or a different hat or the right shoes. But then you're through the door and Corinne, it's all about just getting into that nightclub. And so I spent a really long time with that record, you know, trying to get what they wanted. And I would sort of play a song. We'd either send it or I'd play it in person and kind of I'd be waiting like, is this what they want? And, you know, as time went on, I realized, no, you know, no, it's not. And I'd play a song to kind of a room full of, you know, seven older white men. And, you know, at the end of it, they would say, yeah, it's a good song. Yeah. Just don't see it as the first single, you know, and I just got that a lot. So often that I actually didn't need them in the end to be in the room with me. They were just sort of in my head at all times, you know. So I'd start something and I'd think, oh, what's the point of even finishing this song? You know, isn't, I started to call it international mega smash because that's what they were looking for. So I'd just be like, well, it's not an international mega smash. Like, it's not fast enough. It's not universal enough. It's not melodic enough. It's too weird. It's too long. It's whatever it was, it wasn't what they were looking for. And so I had a really hard time with that record. So with this, with Black Rainbows, I already had in my head, first of all, it's called the Chicago Project. And second of all, it was going to be a side project. It was always going to be not my record. It was going to be this thing. And it was the Chicago Project. And I remember explaining to the team, like, I've seen this building and there's all this stuff. And it's kind of like, it's quite problematic, but sort of writing these songs about, and it won't take me long, and it's just going to be an EP, and you know, and it ended up becoming this massive obsession and the thing that I, you know, thought about pretty much last thing when I went to bed and the first thing when I woke up. And so it was, I knew that I was doing something really different in even just the origin of the music and then of course the style of the music, but it felt really exciting to me to not have to be thinking, is this the right chorus? Is this catchy enough? Is this thing? It's like, I'm writing a 9-minute song about the rock churches of Lalibela. And that's, you know, I just really enjoyed doing it. I was like, let me just, and that was, again, being around all those radical artists at those Black artist retreats in Chicago and New York. I saw how they moved and thought and talked, you know. It was like, I'm a third gender dancer and I'm making a piece about so-and-so. It'll be like, I'm making a documentary about the children in Little Rock High School who were, you know, who were desegregating the school, or I'm making this and I'm doing this sculpture and I'm doing this performance piece. And I just sort of thought, what am I doing? Like, I am in a sort of place of inertia, being frightened to do the wrong thing because of what I've done historically. And I just, you know, it did feel like really exciting to sort of step out of that, you know. And then it felt really exciting to say, actually, this is now gonna be my thing, you know. Yeah.
Thanks, Corinne. It's been such a joy to hear you speak, particularly about your music. But I wonder if I could ask you, how has your faith journey kind of developed and changed over the years from that feisty girl playing in Moortown Baptist?
My faith journey has really evolved. I think, you know, when you say feisty, when you say about that sort of sense of injustice, or, you know, what is injustice, what can be done, those values are still really my values, you know. So I think those issues are still the most important issues to me. You know, I was at the Black Artist Retreat and I was just sat opposite this woman. She was talking about food poverty and she was saying how I think a third of children in Brooklyn in America live in food poverty. And she started to talk to me about this hydroponic farm that she has, you know, where there's the fish and then the fish, it's the water from the fish kind of waters the plants and then the plants grow the vegetables. And then she basically can put all these vegetables in a fridge and people can come along and just take what they want. And as she was talking to me, I just sort of burst into tears. And I really recognized the weight of these tears as being something that I would experience in church or sort of spiritual context, like a sort of calling. And I wasn't embarrassed, but I was really aware, you know, it wasn't just like a single tear. I was just kind of sobbing for 20 minutes in this dinner, because we're all having this really fancy dinner, right, that had been paid for by, you know, someone. Maybe it had been paid for by Theaster, or someone was sponsoring the event. And we're all these artists together eating this beautiful meal. And she's talking to me about a third of the people in Brooklyn, the children, not having any food. And I just had to go to the toilet. So I was in there for ages, just weeping. And I was thinking, you know, the core thing in me that's really still cares about justice and balancing the planet, that's really, I still feel like it's the world's most important work. You know, my sister works with young people in prison, or, you know, young children in care. It's like sometimes my work feels kind of frivolous by comparison. You know, it's like I get to kind of express myself, but I feel like I'm always really conscious in what I do to try and make it as sort of honest and out of the way as possible, because I think for the things that I can do, I want to, you know, have some good influence. But yeah, I think in terms of spirituality, my sort of belief in God, or my belief in a sort of center of love and compassion and justice, is still a really, you know, important part of my life, and still my sort of core. You know, it's still really important to me.
Do we have another question, but hopefully from somebody who hasn't spoken at Greenbelt yet? No? Okay. Oh, gentleman down here.
Hi, thank you both. Corinne, great to hear you speak. I've heard from a few like established artists over the last few years at similar talks like this, and something that's always striking as an artist is that every one of them always says how lucky they feel that they're not trying to break through at this point in time. I think it's interesting what you were both saying about your early years and the community that you had and developed from. I just wonder what each of you might have to say about the importance of those kinds of communities, and what can be done nowadays to kind of begin and maintain that sort of a thing to inspire the next generation of artists.
I think community is really important, but I also think young people now have those communities. Like, those communities still exist. They look different to how the communities that I grew up around, the sort of 80s and 90s, were. And they often are, you know, people that I've met online, you know, and sometimes I've met in real life and sometimes they haven't. But I do think there's a massive amount of support that can happen between young people. And I think, you know, maybe more now than ever, you can find someone who has that same weird interest in that weird bit of literature, or really is passionate about this particular figure from history, or wants to dress in this way, or, you know, you can find someone, and they might be on the other side of the world. But I think, you know, the internet has got this way of connecting people. I think, you know, and I also think that's really important to say, because I am, a 45-year-old woman, but my view of the music scene now is not like, oh, it's so hopeless. I don't feel that. Like, I see young people, you know, I feel like they've been able to find all the music they ever wanted to find, right? They didn't have to go and hang around at a record store or hope somebody's big brother would tell them this, or go, you know, they really can just be sitting on YouTube and think, oh, I like this. What's like this? What's like that? And we see sort of random things, trending and popping up, because young people are really excited about Fleetwood Mac, or really excited about Joni Mitchell, or whoever it is, because they've just discovered it. Or, you know, they can get in front of like a rare Nirvana concert online or something. So I think young people can connect through the internet. They can find loads of experiences. I think, It's harder to have real life things. That's the only thing. I noticed the other day when I went to see a band that there weren't really moving their faces much, or their bodies. And I realized that this particular band has sort of grown up through COVID, and they'd kind of learned to play from those YouTube videos, you know, where it's just like a guy's hand. So it's like they know the fingering on the guitar on both hands, and they can play it really, really well, but they've got much less experience of a person kind of swaying about in a room and losing it and smiling at this bit and frowning at this bit because it's hard to play, and seeing someone in the crowd. And so this part of their body wasn't doing that much, but their hands were really all over it. And I thought, there's definitely something different about that. Mm. And so I think in real life stuff is the best stuff, you know. I've met people on the internet who then became friends, and that's my favorite hang. It's like face to face.
And as Corinne's youth worker, I would say we just created a culture of, if someone had a poem, it was the best poem ever. If someone wrote a song, it was the best song ever. If someone was performing in their garage, we would all turn up. So that was the key part of the community. I'm a 56-year-old man, and the internet is my second language. I'm quite fluent, but it's not my natural language. So as Corinne says, to me, being present with someone through a computer will always feel different to me. But I think just that sense of building a community of affirmation. And I mean, I can say this. I remember the first song that Corinne performed, and I knew from that point that when I said, "That's a really good song," I there wasn't any, you know, gift of encouragement. It was just a fact. You were just one of those people. So I'm glad that you made it through. But I think it is possible, yeah, definitely, that people can grow up in a community of just affirmation and encouragement, and that will take them out of their bedrooms and who knows where.
Absolutely. And I think churches should be like those safe spaces for young people, right? And I, that was one of the biggest buzzes, was it was adults, but it wasn't your parents, you know. It was other adults saying, "Oh, that was good," or like, "Hey, you did that," or, and it just felt, you know, so, you felt so safe as a young person just kind of doing anything and spreading your wings. So for those of you that have those roles, you know, with other people's children, they continue that kind of nodding approval, because those, you know, those relationships mean so much to those young people.
Great. We've maybe got time for one very brief question with a brief answer.
Thank you so much for sharing. I was wondering, is there one song maybe that you're singing tonight that's got a particularly special place in your heart, or whether you feel comfortable sharing the story behind it? And if it's not too cheeky, you might give us a warm-up with it?
Ah. Well, I definitely want you to come back. And a lot of those songs are quite long as well. So, but there's one song I'm going to be singing with just piano, and it is about this woman, Harriet Jacobs, who I had read about as a teenager. And then when I saw her book, her autobiography in the Arts Bank, I reread it and was so connected to that story as a mother and as a woman, because it's a story of a young enslaved girl who grows up in North Carolina in the 1830s. And she has to escape. She has this abusive master who believes he's in love with her. He's obsessed with her. And her life is in danger. She has two young children. Their lives are in danger. So instead of running north where she knows that he'll find her, she hides out on this plantation, the one she was born on. And she hides out in the crawl space above her free grandmother's storehouse. And with the help of her grandmother, you know, she's feeding her and she's taking care of her. She bores this hole in the side of the building so she can look out. And she looks out and she can occasionally see her children, you know, play outside, because her grandmother brings them by there. And she stays there until it's safe to leave, and she stays there in that place for 7 years. So I think a lot about her when I'm singing that song, you know, just what it must be like as a mother to be removed from your children, but you're putting yourself in a place of imprisonment in order to eventually free yourself and to free them, you know, the sort of mental fortitude of that. So that's a really special song to me, with it's called Peach Velvet Sky.
Brilliant. Corinne, thank you ever so much for this time.
Thank you all. Thanks all for listening.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.